It's somehow already election season in Illinois, and Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski will be on the ballot. The Springfield Democrat has repped the district that includes much of the Metro East for two terms now. And unlike her second election in 2024, she's got a challenger from her own party in the primary, a Democratic Socialist. On this episode of Politically Speaking, we catch up with Congresswoman Budzinski about the divide in her party and the recent happenings in Washington, D.C. and the world. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking Podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter, Will Bauer, and joining us for the fourth time is the Congresswoman from Illinois' 13th Congressional District.
Great to be with you, Will,
yeah,
as always.
Yeah. So, man, I know you're busy with Congress and all the shenanigans that come with that, but somehow we are less than a month away from early voting.
Mm-hmm. We are. And I will say that the new year has really kind of hit off with a bang. I mean, there's been so much that's happened this week alone. So there's so much happening in Washington. That work continues, but we are inching closer to the next election.
And I want to talk about many of those things that have happened to start off the new year. But before that, I wanted to kind of talk about maybe the broader trend or the discussions happening in the Democratic Party. And I think in a lot of ways, your primary race maybe exemplifies some of those bigger discussions. And I think we should start it with maybe a discussion of what prompted it, which is the 2024 election. So from your vantage point, what went wrong for your party in November 2024?
Well, look, I think that one of the things that as a party we lost touch with in a lot of the communities even that I visit as a national party, that connection to working people. You know, I'm grounded in the work that I did in the labor movement prior to running for office, you know, fighting for families that just want to get ahead. They want to build a better life for their kids. They want us in Washington to stay focused on how we can make their lives easier and better and more affordable. And I think in 2024, the Democrats, we spent too much time trying to convince working people that the economy was good. And we were coming at them with a lot of facts and figures. Interestingly, I think that's something that President Trump is also making that same mistake right now, too, with facts and figures that just don't resonate. I think what I learned in 2024 is that how you feel about your day-to-day and how your family's doing is really a feeling. It's not a statistic. And so I think in 2024, we weren't making that case in a compelling way that people felt, that we had a plan to make their lives better and that we had more work to do.
It's almost like there's a disconnect between, the way the voter sentiment and the everyday sentiment of working class people versus like the key economic indicators that maybe say in a historic way the economy looks like it's performing well, but for whatever reason, it doesn't feel that way.
I don't think it feels that way right now, for sure. And I think that that's why President Trump, when he ran, he said on day one, I'm going to address rising costs. I'm going to make things more affordable. And he's done nothing like that. If anything, I think the constituents that I represent are saying that things have only gotten more expensive. And I think that's been in a multitude of different areas. It's not just at the grocery store. It's also utility bills, especially in my district, have gone up significantly. It's also healthcare. We spent a lot of the end of last year talking about how we were going to address the ACA tax credits, which just helped to make healthcare more affordable, help people address rising premiums. So all of those things are still real, very serious pain points that people are dealing with.
And I want to talk more about ACA and affordability. But before we move on, I did want to ask one more question about the 2024 election. And I know you worked in the Biden administration for the first couple of years. Do you think that he should have ever run for a second term at his age?
Yeah, I think he was too old to run. I think that that's obvious. I think that there were lessons learned from the Democratic Party as far as speaking out, I think we would have really benefited from having a robust primary. I think that we're going to have that in 2028, which I think is a good thing. And so, you know, I think that it doesn't do us a lot of good, though, looking back as much as kind of this is where we are now. And I will say there are so many fires right now, and there's so much fear, and there's so much anxiety with us dealing with the aftermath of the 2024 election, which is the Trump administration in a second term, which is quite frankly, nothing even like Trump's first term. It is much more disastrous. It is much more frightening. And so what I've been mostly focused on today is what I can do to help relieve those fears that my constituents wake up with every day and how I'm still working to make their lives easier and better.
I think there's been a lot of dialogue in the last or since the 2024 election about there's a younger generation of Democrats that kind of feel that the current congressional Democrats aren't pushing back as aggressively against the Trump administration. And I think maybe two votes in Illinois that maybe exemplify that would be two Senator Durbin votes. The first one was in March to, I think it was a continuing resolution to keep the government funded. The second one was this past fall, to end the government shutdown. And I know you didn't vote for either of those in the House, but maybe comparing a House vote to a Senate vote isn't apples and oranges. Do you think, though, he was wrong to take those two votes?
Yeah, I disagreed with him on those votes. I work very closely with Senator Durbin, and I will say I have immense respect for him, and I'm going to miss him deeply when he does retire at the end of this year. I think we disagree with each other sometimes as elected officials, and that's okay. I think at the core of this, though, is for the Democrats, when we are not in control of the White House and the Senate and the House, and we have our Democratic activists and constituents fearful every day of what this administration is doing and how it's impacting their daily lives, they are expecting us to show up and fight every day, something that I believe I do every day. But I think it does also come down to how we're fighting and the leverage that we are able to actually have when we don't have any of the three levers of power. And so I think if I could point to one thing that I think was a big success for us this week, you know, we raised hell at the end of last year about the ACA tax credits and the end of the deadline being December 31st. That was a lot of what we were focused on as it related to the shutdown itself. And while we didn't get that across the finish line, at the end of last year, what you did see this week was we were able to bring along four Republicans in the House on a discharge petition, which I think for constituents that are like, what's a discharge petition? It's really a leverage, a procedural motion that we have on the floor to actually have members sign a petition to say, we want this, we compel this bill to be called to the House floor, because Speaker Mike Johnson refused to do it. And so we were able to bring that to a vote this week, and we were able to get out of the House a three-year extension on the ACA tax credits. That was because of the fortitude and the discipline and the fight that the House Democrats have. And that's me showing up. Every time I had an opportunity to fight for those tax credits, I did. And this week we were able to get it out of the House. I don't know where it's going in the Senate. We have to continue to fight and urge our Senate counterparts to take immediate action. But from a House perspective, and that's my job, I need to show up and fight for those issues. And we did, and we were successful this week.
And given that those tax credits were kind of at the center of the shutdown, do you think, and I hate boiling politics that impacts people's lives into a win or loss column, but I know there was a lot of people in the Democratic Party that felt we have the upper hand in this government shutdown discussion. Was it a mistake for Senator Durbin and the seven others of the Democratic caucus to agree with Republicans to end the shutdown without the ACA subsidies?
Yeah, I think the honest answer is we'll never know. I mean, I think that that shut down the shutdown, so to speak, that reopened the government. I think, though, at that time, and I was visiting with a lot of food banks, I was talking to a lot of constituents who were facing empty EBT cards going into the holidays. We were seeing flights being canceled. There were definitely very, very real pain points. Can I say for certain that had we held out, something would have broke and maybe we could have gotten done? Maybe. And that's why I voted against the continuing resolution. But I think the short answer is we don't know. But what did come out of it, again, just trying to stay on the positive is we did actually force it to a vote this week in the House, and we got it out of the House. So not perfect, but it was a fight worth fighting, I think.
Were you shocked that it passed the House?
Well, look, I honestly was shocked. To be honest, there were 17 Republicans that joined us in that final vote. I was surprised that there weren't more. And why I'm surprised is because health care has become too expensive in this country. And that's not in blue districts. That's in red districts. What this administration, it's in both districts, but what this administration has done to health care in this first year is horrible. I mean, we're talking about ACA, but there are so many other Americans that rely on Medicaid to help them be able to access a hospital, access preventative health care. They've gutted almost by $1 trillion, Medicaid dollars. So it's not that this ACA tax credit is happening in a vacuum. All of our constituents in every single district in this country are feeling the pain of unaffordable health care. I am just shocked that Republicans, only 17 of them, joined us.
And maybe continuing on that discussion of affordability, one of the politicians who kind of sparked a lot of discussion about affordability is the new New York City mayor. And I want to ask you more about affordability in a second. But while we're kind of talking about, you know, the fight or the discussions happening amongst Democrats, what, if anything, do you think his election in New York City says about broader Democratic politics in 2025 or now 2026?
Is that people want us to focus on affordability and cost of living, and they want big ideas to do that, and that there's a hunger out there for authenticity. I think Mamdani is a very authentic leader in the party, and I think he spoke to his beliefs. I think I don't agree with him on all of his beliefs, certainly, but I do believe that he's authentic. He met people where they were. He made commitments, and he understood, most importantly, the cost of living in the most expensive city in the country was something that needed to be tackled. And so I think, you know, again, going back to lessons learned from 2024, it is about working people. It's about helping them get ahead. When they see corporations all across this country and internationally making so much record profits, so many record profits, and they're not getting ahead, the system is unfair and it's rigged against them, and we can do better. And I think in that election, he spoke to that. I would also argue, though, my colleagues, Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill, who became governors of New Jersey and Virginia, also successfully, in their own style and in their own way, for their states, spoke to that. It was about affordability, and all three of them won on that.
What should Congress do? And I know we're kind of discussing the ACA. I would imagine the subsidies would be a potential solution to healthcare costs. But what else should Congress be doing to address affordability if it's not this year after the 2026 midterms?
That's a great question, because we stayed very focused on the ACA tax credits, and that while that is one tool to helping to make healthcare more affordable, it's not a one and done situation. There are so many other things we can be doing to tackle affordability, because I do believe we live in the richest country in the world, and healthcare should be affordable and accessible to everyone. The tax credits are one thing. The other thing I've been co-leading on is taking on pharmacy benefit managers. They're the middlemen. This is bipartisan too, Will. This is a middleman that is standing in between the patient and the pharmaceutical company, helping to set the prices for pharmaceutical drugs in this country. And I would argue they are jacking up the prices of those drugs. We need more transparency in that industry. And I've signed on to legislation to do that. I also think that as a country, we should allow for more drug negotiations as it relates to Medicare, and even in the private sector, the private industry as well. For example, Democrats were the one that capped the cost of insulin at $35 for those on Medicare. We should do that for those in private insurance, on private insurance plans too. But we shouldn't stop with insulin. We should continue to find more drugs to negotiate on and bring down the cost of prescription drugs. But it isn't just with health care. Just today on the House floor, I voted on a piece of legislation to help build more homes. We have an affordable housing crisis. We need to build more homes. We need to clear out the bureaucracy to make it easier to build more homes in this country. I voted on that just today. I would also say I'm finding opportunities to speak out and fight for working people in my district when it comes to those that are customers of Family Dollar or Dollar General. I've led a letter with 29 other colleagues when I found out through a Guardian investigation that Family Dollar and Dollar General are what I believe engaging in deceptive pricing, meaning customers are showing up to their stores, finding a lower price on the shelf, and then going to the register. If they recognize that there's a higher price, and some don't, if they recognize it and they call it out, the store is not honoring the lower price that the customer had originally found on the shelf. That's wrong. And during a time when people are really struggling to make ends meet, I think that's a common sense thing that we should be fighting on in Washington and looking for ways to find, you know, federal enforcement mechanisms to crack down on these corporations.
Also wanted to ask you about immigration, a little bit of a pivot, but just given that maybe the data does show that border crossings have dropped pretty dramatically since President Trump took office, I wonder, do you think that Democrats in the Biden White House made a mistake with how they handled the border, at least in the first couple of years of his administration?
Absolutely. I've said that pretty consistently. I think they did not do enough. They didn't take what was happening at the border serious enough. I think at the end of the President Biden's administration, and when I say end, I think it was in September of the election year, he decided to invest more fully in border security. It was way too late. We do need strong borders. We do need investment in our borders. But what we are seeing in this country is not that. What we are seeing with ICE and ICE agents is horrendous. What happened in Minneapolis with that tragedy, a woman lost her life, is horrific. And we need a full investigation and accountability. And I know that this administration seems to think that ICE is above the law. They are not. And it's why I'm joining some of my Democratic colleagues in calling out and saying that Kristi Noem should be stepping down. I think she's unfit to serve in that office. Look, we have a broken immigration system in this country. This administration is doing nothing but creating terror in our communities, terrorizing immigrant communities, dividing families, taking away our neighbors. It's terrifying. And so what we need is to get back to a place where, yes, we are investing in border security, but we are also creating a real pathway for legal status for people that want to stay in our communities and contribute. I feel like we forget that we're a country of immigrants. We're all immigrants. At some point, we came to this country. And we've really lost our way on this issue. We need to get back to the middle. We need to find some bipartisanship on this issue and some humanity.
Wanted to ask, too, about Venezuela. What do you make of the Trump administration's decision to capture Nicolas Maduro?
Well, at the outset, I would just say Maduro is a bad guy. I mean, I think he is an illegitimate leader. I think he's a thug. I think it's good that he's gone. But I think the question is really about how this administration decided to carry out this strike in Venezuela with zero communication with Congress, absolutely no transparency with the American people. And then now we're faced with a situation where President Trump is saying we are in full control of a foreign country. We are in full control of Venezuela, while he continues to ratchet up rhetoric around Greenland, Mexico, Colombia. And I think if there's anything we've all learned in this last year is that when President Trump says something, we should take what he's saying very seriously. And I think that's terrifying. I think it's why you saw action in the Senate, bipartisan action. I saw Senator Hawley joined in supporting a war powers resolution to cut off this administration's ability to continue these military operations. Many of them, I think, are tantamount to acts of war in Venezuela. I would be supporting that if it gets to the House. And I think what it is also is it's missing the complete point of what people want in this country. People need help with their everyday lives. People need to know that things are being made more affordable, that this president is tackling and sees this healthcare crisis in this country. We don't want foreign wars. We want to focus on how we're rebuilding, how we're supporting our families, and how we're bringing down costs. And he's absolutely not doing any of that.
Do you think that resolution that, I guess, the Senate, correct me if I'm wrong here, maybe took a procedural vote to discuss it more, so they would still need to vote on it again?
Right.
If it does get to the House, though, do you think there's actually a path for it to pass?
Look, I think that you're going to have a lot of support from the Democrats, and I wouldn't be surprised if you'll have some Republicans also supportive of it. I think it does have a chance to pass. Now, the bigger question is, then this gets to President Trump's desk, and is he actually going to sign that? And obviously, I'd be very skeptical of that. But I think that we need to use every lever that we can to stand up again to this administration, which I'm committed to doing on a daily basis. And this is one opportunity for us to tell him, stop, stop this. Focus on our people. Focus on what we need to be focused on, which is bringing down costs and making things more affordable.
Before we let you go, I did want to talk about some local issues. I wanted to talk about Granite City Works, because I was honestly a little surprised to learn in December that U.S. Steel was going to restart one of the two blast furnaces at some point this spring.
Yeah.
What do you make of that announcement?
Look, I think that it's positive. Any day that we can have folks working, we can have the great men and women of the steelworkers working at Granite City Works, and the blast furnaces coming back on means that hundreds of steelworkers that are the best, most talented, capable workforce making steel, making profits for this company. They're at work. That's a good day. But I think that I've tried to be also realistic about that these are good short-term wins. What we want is a longer-term investment. And that's something that we still have yet to achieve, and something that I am working toward every day alongside Mayor Parkinson, the mayor of Granite City, alongside our state partners, the governor, our state legislators, Republicans and Democrats, and the United Steelworkers, to make the best case to this company that they should be investing in the long term in Granite City Works. And I'm not going to rest until we get to see that longer term investment.
And just south of there, I wanted to ask about your congressional office actually just put out a release about this. A handful of projects in the Metro East, water projects, I should say, got funded in the House budget. These include $7 million for one of the many sewer projects in Cahokia Heights, and also $500,000 for an Army Corps report about the East St. Louis area. Why are these important? And then I think the Senate would still need to sign off on them, too.
They do.
Okay.
They do, but we feel good about the Senate because this was a four corners agreement, meaning that Democrats and Republicans in the Senate agreed to the bills that came to the floor this week. So we know that it should get to passage in the Senate. But I'm very excited about these projects. This work that we've been doing collaboratively with the mayor of Cahokia Heights, with, again, state leaders and Senator Duckworth and Senator Durbin, who also were a part of us advocating for these funds. This is just us continuing to make progress in an issue, in a systemic, multi-generational issue of flooding that has plagued the city and the area of Cahokia Heights. I've been focused on this since the first day I came into office, and I'm not going to rest until it gets resolved. These two funding pieces, I think, are big steps in the right direction. Over, as you mentioned, $7 million for an East Interceptor investment, which is just investing in the sewer lines in Cahokia Heights. Very proud to do that alongside Senator Duckworth. And then with Senator Durbin, we advocated and successfully got the $550,000 of a study for the region. We haven't actually had a full and complete Army Corps of Engineers study of the region, of all of the different things that we need to do to see this project and this work get to completion. This is going to update that and really give us the roadmap to what we need, all the things that we need in order to reach resolution. So I'm excited about both of them for different reasons, but they obviously all fit together in this master puzzle piece or puzzle that we have. That is Cahokia Heights, but to see resolution and finally justice for these constituents that have had literally raw sewage, you know, coming up into their homes from pipes that have been outdated and flooding that has been neglected and not dealt with for far too long.
Final two thoughts. I wanted to ask you, I don't think I've seen you endorse someone for the vacant Senate seat for retiring Senator Dick Durbin's seat. Will you make a endorsement in that race?
Yeah, I'm not really planning to, and the reason is that two of them are my colleagues, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, and then I'm friends with our Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who I do think is a wonderful person and running a good campaign. I think they all offer different things. I think all of them have big shoes to fill, obviously, for Senator Durbin. With his vacancy, so I'm watching the race myself, just like everybody else.
What will it take for Democrats to take back the House in the midterms?
I think it's staying focused on affordability. It's staying focused on the issues that working people care about. I call them the issues that wake people up at night. It's how am I going to pay for my utility bill, or am I going to be able to pay for childcare for my kid? How am I going to balance, you know, groceries versus my rent? These are the struggles that I think people are facing every day, and making the case that as Democrats, we are the ones that are best suited to fight for them and get real results done for them in Washington. And I think we're going to win because of that. I think it's that. I think it's a 1-2 punch, though. I think it really is to create a check on the Trump administration. If voters want a check, if they want accountability, we have to elect a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives in November.
If there are voters out there that want to find out more about you or your campaign, where can they learn more?
Yes, thank you, Will. If you'd like to go to my campaign, it's just nikkiforcongress.com. Or if you're checking out, if you're a constituent and you have a case or something you'd like us to be working on or want to reach out to my official office, it's budzinski.house.gov.
Many dots.
Many dots.
Well, thank you so much, Congresswoman, for joining us.
Thanks, Will.
Dylan Blaha, Budzinski's opponent in the Democratic primary, will appear on a future episode of Politically Speaking. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Until next time, so long.